So I'm David Sliva, and I'd like to welcome you to this workshop, An Introduction to Growing Pears. First, I'd like to say that there are two other handouts that I expected to be here, and apparently they're looking for them right now, so they'll hopefully arrive soon. So in the mother tongue, my name is David Sliva. And when I was born, my grandfather, my Polish immigrant grandfather, planted a pear tree outside of my bedroom window. And I grew up with that pear tree. And I'm quite certain that my lifelong interest in pears is a result of that experience. And when my life's journey brought me to a place where I could plant pear trees, I planted pear trees. So what I'd like to start with is to share some of the experiences that I've had growing pears on two farms. At Meadow Farm, from 1980 until 2016, and at Plum Ridge Farm, from 2016 to the present. At Meadow Farm, I grew 74 varieties of pear and used 10 different pear rootstocks. On Plum Ridge Farm, I'm growing 38 varieties of pear. Almost all of them are on a single rootstock, on the same rootstock, Old Home by Farmingdale 87. And almost all of those varieties are fire blight resistant varieties. At Meadow Farm, I found out of those 74 varieties that I was trialing, a few that were really good market pears. Luscious, Gourmet, Warden Seckle, and Summer Crisp. Now the Luscious and the Gourmet were two varieties bred in Brookings, South Dakota, in 67 and 87 releases. The Warden Seckle, a seedling of the old popular Seckle, and then Summer Crisp, a University of Minnesota release, I think probably in the 80s. At any rate, those I was able to market very successfully. Two other pears I'll mention, a very early one called Giffard, not a very abundant producer, but an excellent, very early variety for us in the core area, northeast Iowa, zone 4B. In mid-August, we would be harvesting the Giffards. And then on the other end of that, winter pear, a winter Nellis, which we harvested in November, and it would rock hard, and it would just keep well into the new year and mellow out as the time went on. At Plum Ridge, in the 2022 growing season, last growing season, I had the joy of fruiting for the first time four varieties of pear: Gem, Cold Snap, Shenandoah, and Bosque. And I really surprised myself. The Bosque was exquisite. I really didn't think I could grow such a fine pear, but it was really a wonderful surprise. First harvests though, so yet to find out how it will perform, how these varieties will perform, how all of them will do. So along the way, I was very curious about the lack of a truly dwarfing rootstock for pear. And that led me to two projects, each lasting about 10 years. And one of them had to do with trialing various quinces as a dwarfing rootstock for pear. Now, quince has been used for centuries, basically, as a dwarfing rootstock for pears, but it is not hardy. I've tried it. I've tried several strains of it at my location, and true enough, as I expected, they didn't survive. But hardy quince may be on its way. I acquired from the National Clonal Germplasm Repository for Quince, located in Corvallis, Oregon, 17 provenances of hardy quince, or quinces that I was testing for hardiness. And then the other project that I took on for about a 10-year span was looking at Amelanchier as a dwarfing rootstock for pears, otherwise known as Juneberry, Saskatoon, Serviceberry, has various synonyms. At any rate, those two projects were fun to conduct, and I had some interesting results. And I was happy to learn in the last several years that both of those projects, that is looking at hardy quince and looking at Amelanchier as potential dwarfing rootstocks for pears, really have a vigorous research program out in Oregon at the Oregon State University Research Station, particularly at Hood River. So there's a lot of work being done on finding that hardy quince for northern areas, and also very promising combinations of Amelanchier. Now, Amelanchier, one species or another, is native to all of North America. All the states have some quince. And I tried four different ones. And the one that seems to have been used out in Oregon actually was developed in Germany. And it's a cross of the Amelanchier spicata and alnifolia. At any rate, that's I think we can sometime find along the way commercially available these stocks available for us to use with our pears. But in the meanwhile, let's look at what rootstocks are available and which ones we can use here now. So we'll go on with this. So here are the topics I'd like to cover. Selecting pear varieties to grow, choosing for disease resistance. Now, I put a question mark behind that. We just don't know yet if these disease-resistant varieties are going to work for us here in our zones, 4B and colder. Secondly, training and pruning, managing for high-quality fruit. Now, that will be the area that I'll spend most time on, because I think that's probably one of the most important orchard jobs that there is. And then thirdly, looking at harvesting, determining maturity and ripeness. We'll look at some of those factors that will allow us to harvest at the right time and get a pear out there to the consumer that is ripe and ready to eat. And then finally, I would like to leave enough time for questions and comments. So there'll be various times we'll spend on each of those. So we'll start with that one. Selecting pear varieties to grow. As I mentioned, fire blight resistant varieties are, in my opinion, the choice to make. As organic growers, it gives us a leg up in terms of being successful. But there is that caveat. There are no proven fire blight resistant varieties that will grow in our area. That is, I should say, of those that were released in the last several decades, there are old, the Luscious, for example, as far as I can tell, from all the reports I've read, is fire blight resistant. But it's not touted as one of those fire blight resistant varieties. And I also am very partial, as I mentioned, the Bosque. It's an old pear, a couple hundred years old, so it stood the test of time, as have the three main pear varieties grown in this country and around the world, the Bosques, the Anjous, and the Bosques. They're not fire blight resistant in the least, but they're of high quality. And so, in my opinion, they're worth trying. If you're aware that you are growing, your farm is in a high fire blight area, probably hold off on those. But if there doesn't seem to be a lot of inoculum in your area, worth a try. And then finally, there are what I'm calling niche varieties, if they're really good keepers, unique pairs in various regards, or unknown varieties that are good, that are found locally. I have found several just by traveling around the countryside in my area in the spring and looking for that white bloom out there in the fields or wooded areas. And surprisingly, they do show up now and then. I mentioned the National Clonal Germplasm Repository. Yes.
This feels like a silly question, but I guess this is an intro class. But could you talk about fire blight and like what it is and what it does?
Sure. And let's hold that to that comment and discussion period. Yeah, because that can get quite involved as well. But yes, definitely. Let's do that. I mentioned the National Clonal Germplasm Repository in Corvallis, Oregon. And as you can see, they have almost 1,000 varieties of European pears there, and a couple of hundred Asians, and then, as you can see, other categories. But I have obtained many of the cultivars that I'm growing, especially those that aren't readily available or grown, from the repository as signwood, and cultivated them myself. So there's a lot of varieties out there for us to choose from. So let's, without getting into about the fire blight itself, let's just look at some of the varieties that I'm recommending for trial. And I do want to emphasize that as well. And you can see the list, but I also want to point out the USDA scale for fire blight resistance. It's a scale that was developed and runs from 1 to 10. One being the most susceptible, or at least no resistance probably, and 10 being the least susceptible. And we can see that Bartlett is somewhere between 3 and 4. Whereas all of these other fire blight resistant varieties, those from both the USDA breeding program and the Canadian breeding program, are at least 6 to some 10, almost immunity. But none of them are immune, but they're very high resistance. And I should mention, too, that all of these slides and this information is on that one handout. And I think a second or more, or maybe other handouts are coming. Yep. So that's just something to be aware of. Many of the varieties that, like, as again, I'll hearken back to varieties such as Luscious, we just don't know where on this scale that it would fall. We do know the varieties that have been studied extensively, like the Bartlett, for example, that has been determined. So we can figure that out for ourselves as we go. And as this discussion continues, you'll see that we have a lot to learn about growing pears in the upper Midwest, but we're on our way. This is another handout. Excuse me, have those handouts come in yet? Oh, they have, okay. Okay, thank you. So this will be a handout that is available because it's helpful because of all of the text and boxes. It's maybe hard to read very easily. But I put this up here. Again, it's another listing of those fire blight resistant varieties, but it also, I've included this little table right here, and it's fire blight resistant varieties that are being planted by commercial growers, both in the Pacific Northwest, where the bulk of the pears in this country are grown. I think 95% of pears are grown in Oregon, Washington, and in California too. And also in Pennsylvania. We don't have data for pears being tried in the upper Midwest, except I did do a survey a couple of years ago on this lower table of 15 different orchards spread out around Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. And those were the most popular varieties grown, not necessarily by the quantity of trees, but by of those 15 orchards, 15 of those were growing luscious. So it was the most common variety across all of those orchards. But getting back to this middle table, so commercial growers are going to take a good hard look at these varieties and choose to try to grow those that they think are the most likely to be good commercial varieties. So I take that as a good way to try to figure out which ones to try too. Although I am trying whatever is available because you never know. However, that's what I see as a value for this middle table. And as you can see, both in Pennsylvania and in the Pacific Northwest, the top of that list is, or one of them is the Harrow Sweet. And we'll talk a little bit more about that variety because it seems to be one of the chosen ones, so to speak. And yet, results are mixed here in the Midwest. So we need to, as I started to say initially, be cautious about this, but choose what seems might be the best and go with that. The next few slides I'm just going to put through here as varieties that have done well for me over the years. This is one, as I mentioned, Luscious has been by far the most consistent heavy producer year in and year out, even when many of the other varieties were either frosted out or when we had extremely late frosts, or for whatever reason didn't produce a full crop, but Luscious seemed to. And I'll talk a little bit more too about the fact that pears, unlike apples, seem not to respond as apples do. If you thin the fruit much, you'll get an increased size in the remaining crop. Pears don't seem to mind being next to each other. So this is the Luscious. Note the rootstock. I'll talk a little bit more about rootstocks in general, but I first got started with 333. It's not an industry favorite, but it worked well. Gourmet is the other one. Again, these are both South Dakota pears. Warden Seckle, again, a very old pear from the 1890s, a seedling. I didn't get consistent results with this particular variety, but it was very prolific and it did market well. The Winter Nellis I did mention as well, for a really late season pear, this would be a good choice. Okay, let's look at these rootstocks. So, I didn't want to go there. I want to go back. So here's Old Home Farmingdale 87, which is far and away the most popular rootstock in the industry today. I would say in the last several years, the rootstock that has been, I would say any new plantings of pears have been on Old Home Farmingdale 87, almost exclusively. And the other one has been Old Home Farmingdale 97. However, 97, as you can see, has hardly any, if at all, any dwarfing to it. But 87 is in that two-thirds the size of a seedling, and the seedling would be 100% and about 25 feet tall and about the same in spread. That's generally the consideration. So what I'm looking for is what in the pears would be comparable to the apple rootstocks, either like the M9s, the Bud9s, or say something like the G41. Now G41 for apples is being very commonly used now. M9 has been out there for over 100 years. It was kind of the original dwarfing rootstock in that category of the 30-40% range in size. So what in the pears would fit or correspond to this category of apples? Well, if we look in that same category, the sort of that 40 or less than 40, you can see there are a lot of quince, for sure. And then that amelanchier that I mentioned is way over here, it's less than 40%. So in fact, if we can find that amelanchier that will work for us and or that hardy quince, we will get a truly dwarfing rootstock for pears. So if you're inclined to experiment, that might be something to try. Otherwise, sometime down the road, I'm sure we'll see it available commercially. Some of the advantages that I feel are important in growing pears on a dwarf stock. Okay, so at this point, that's about what I wanted to say about selecting varieties. Some old ones, some new ones, fire blight resistant ones, some other good ones, kind of in a nutshell. And you've got the handouts there. And you can, if you're starting out or wanting to add to your orchard, those might be some selections that you can look at closer. Let's look at training and pruning. So fruit trees are going to produce fruit. I mean, that's their job. So why should we prune? Well, if we do prune, we can influence the quality and the quantity of the fruit produced. And if we're growing for market, that's what we really want to do. We're going to wait a while for that tree to produce, and then it's going to produce for many years. And if we want to market fruit, we should try to do the best job we can in getting quality and quantity. And the better pruning job we do, the more high quality and quantity we will harvest. I would maintain, however, that pruning of any sort is better than no pruning. This is a tree. This is a pear tree. I don't know what variety it is. This is at the Iowa Horticultural Research Station down near Ames. It's probably been there for many decades, and it hasn't been pruned in very recent times, as you can see. So we'll talk about what happens to a pear tree and why it happens a little bit. But you can see the very upright growth in the top and the very somewhat spreading way down on the bottom. And in a situation like that, yes, there will be fruit. There will be quality fruit. But where will it be? It'll be right here on the periphery. And I would maintain that 3/4 or more of that tree will not produce any fruit or produce fruit of very poor quality and small size. So let's dig into why that happens and what we can do about it. Pruning pears and apples is very similar, but there are some major differences. Pears differ with a much stronger apical dominance and a lower leaf efficiency, 20% lower. So let's look at apical dominance. What does that mean? It means that terminal bud up there is secreting a hormone called auxin, and that inhibits the buds beneath it for probably at least a foot and maybe 16 to 18 inches. So there will be hardly any laterals there. Same with these shoots. And that tip, when it's growing, will just keep growing like it did on that previous slide. And that's why we got many, many stems just going to the sky and straight up. And we'll look at what we can do to help ourselves alleviate that situation, because we don't want trees that are exceedingly tall. We want something we can manage and get to. Nice to do it from the ground, but also at least something accessible from a ladder. I personally don't like to use a ladder that's taller than 8 feet, which means I don't get on the top of it. I'm probably standing about 6 feet at most above the ground, and I'm topping my trees above that with where I can reach. So knowing what's influencing the growth here is going to help us know how to prune. I would suggest that a training system is only limited by one's imagination. You can chain a tree any way you want, as long as you consider one thing. The most important thing in training and pruning a tree is be sure that most of that canopy gets direct sunlight. Everything else about pruning is pure nuance. If you don't get sunlight onto that branch, you will not get fruit bud set. You'll get diminished photosynthesis, and you will get inferior fruit. So in any pruning you do or any training system you do, it can look like anything. That tree can look like any shape or form you want, as long as the sunlight is able to get into those branches all the way into the interior. If you do that, it's guaranteed that you will get good quality fruit. And it's particularly important for pears. As I pointed out here, on the previous slide, the efficiency of photosynthesis of the pear leaf is apparently not quite as easily or as efficient as the apple, so that that means that pear leaves are really sensitive to shade. They just don't perform as well. So we do really need to pay attention to getting sunlight into the tree. And obviously, you need to start with the fruit bud set. If you don't get fruit buds this year, you don't have a crop next year. And if you don't have good, plump, healthy fruit buds, then you won't get quality fruit. So that's the important part of pruning, in my opinion. Oh, I should also mention where we saw that large overgrown tree at the Iowa State Horticultural Research Station. They did have a trial there of, again, fire blight resistant varieties. Yes. We can, and I'll get into other systems. And that particular one, we can talk about that as well. Yeah. These are also there at that experiment station, and they are a trial that I just became aware of a couple of years ago. So my wife and I went down and tried to document them. And I will say that particularly in this case, you can see, I think this is a good example of a well-pruned pear tree. And I think most of these, I think that one in particular is on Old Home Farmingdale 87. So, you know, it's probably up in that 12 to 14 foot height, or maybe not quite, but about that. But you can see all those spurs on all those pruning branches. So it's going to be quite productive. Good sunlight. Basically, if you're dealing with a central leader tree, you'll want to end up with something that's conical in shape, something like a Christmas tree or a pyramid, so that they're very short branches at top, and they can extend out a little further. But we'll look at the systems that were brought up, the Lorette pruning system and others, that obviously aren't going to follow exactly the same patterns, but they do still need to conform to the principle of getting light into the tree. Here's an example of an early orchard at Meadow Farm, which taught me quite a few lessons. So this is, and that's a summer crisp, probably in its third or fourth year, on Epeirus eucerensis roots, and they're spaced 20 by 20. So that's a pretty wide spacing. I mean, maybe 50 years ago, people were planting orchards on 40 by 40. But a 20 by 20 is a wide spacing, but I'm also using a seedling, in this case, it's actually a clonal rootstock, but it's of seedling size. It'll be full-size tree. Summer crisp tends to be a very vigorous sign. So putting a vigorous sign on a vigorous rootstock is not the best combination because it will produce a timber tree. And we're fruit producers. We're not growing timber. So we want to get the right combination of a rootstock and a scion that's going to work wonderfully together. There'll be a good balance of vegetative production and fruit so that there's a lot of photosynthesis going on, a lot of carbohydrates produced, and that can be used for developing some vegetative wood, some fruit, and some stored in the roots, or some for the roots to grow, and some stored for the following season. So what I discovered is that it was pretty hard to fill out the space at a 20 by 20, but the next slide will show what I did with that space. However, I want to point out here that because of the upright growth, spreading those branches, instead of having them grow like this, have them grow at 45 degrees, for example. So what's happening there? Here's the leader, and here's that tip that's prohibiting the growth of laterals. It's just going to keep going up. And how does that tip prohibit the growth of those laterals? The auxin goes down by gravity. We can modify that by spreading that branch, and then the effect of apical dominance is somewhat reduced. We don't want to go too far because then we get into problems with fruiting wood. So apparently that 45 to 60 degree angle is ideal for modifying the effect of apical dominance and yet the production of good healthy fruit buds. So that's important. When you start off with a young whip like this on this slide, I use toothpicks to start those spreading. And once they're spread after one season, they won't spring back, of course. The wood will be formed there. And clothespins sometimes are used on larger laterals to spread them as well, and any number of other techniques on larger branches to weigh them down, tie them down, or however you want to get them down. In between the younger trees, I grew a variety of crops, lots of vegetables, flowers, and I really liked the strawberries. They did exceedingly well there. So for several years, we grew a large amount of our market garden in our orchard because it worked so well. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about different systems. I'm not going to mention the Lorette one right now, but we can do that later in discussion. That's a specific type of training and technique. But multiple leaders seems to be getting very popular now. In other words, think about this. If you're talking about a central leader, you've got all of your energy going up into that central leader. If you do it with two on the same tree, you're dividing that and you're somewhat reducing the vigor. So it makes logical sense that would be helpful in reducing the size of the tree. And that's a very, biaxial ones are very common, but it can be modified to include many more axials. So let's look at some of the others. And it gets us, it also allows us to do something that's like this. I haven't seen this on pear yet, but this is something that is really pretty interesting in that you can see the way that this is a single root system and has two leaders coming up, but they're trained in this form. And then each one of these becomes a leader, so that on one rootstock, there's probably a dozen leaders, greatly reducing the vigor of any single one, but they have to be kind of equal so that no one is going to be taking over. And it's basically, you come up with a fruiting wall here. It's just a painted wall of fruit. And you see how thick that canopy is? Barely wider than the post in that trellis. This is an end view of that row. So that, I mean, that's an apple. So I haven't seen that in pears yet. But it came out in the most recent Good Fruit Grower. If folks aren't familiar with the Good Fruit Grower, I would suggest that this is a wonderful resource. And the centerpiece of that is what's partially shown up there. And I can pass this around so that you can kind of maybe take a look at it. And maybe if you're not familiar with the magazine, take a look at it as well. It covers a lot of different fruits, and it's covers nationwide. So I find it as a good resource. Every once in a while, there's articles I clip out that pertain to my own interests. But if you just pass that around, you can kind of see. Pretty impressive. Yes? Yeah. Yeah, there's it's a trellis wire. Yeah, in fact, I think this might be a tie right in there. Well, no, I think it is. No, not quite. They do tie. The branches are tied to the wires, and there's a second. You can see the two wires here. So as those leaders grow up, they'll be tied to that, so that. I mean, it's just a lot of pears, a lot of apples in this case. Yep. Okay. Here's more local. As you'll notice in that article and those pictures, that's something being done in Italy. Very progressive fruit growers there. Not all necessarily the best, but in terms of what's being happening to some of that land, but nonetheless, they're thinking about how to grow fruit in a new way, or do it a different way at least. So this is in Mount Horeb, Rami Abaromia. Maybe several folks might know Rami. So when my wife and I visited a few years ago, we looked at his pear plantings. He grows a lot of mostly apples, but lots of pears and other fruits. And he's using Old Home Farmingdale 87 roots, spaced 5 feet apart in the row, so pretty close, pretty high density. You know, at that spacing, you're going to get at least several hundred trees on an acre, if not more. But he's going with a pretty high trellis. They're about 10 feet tall. And he's using Harrow Sweet. You know, he chose that because that was a promising variety, and it is very productive in certain areas. However, I just visited with Rami about a couple of weeks ago, and he's top working many of these trees. They're going over to Luscious. And why? Lots of winter kill on Harrow Sweet, scab, and sooty blotch. As I said, this is a promising fire blight resistant variety. Commercial growers are planting it at scale. Doesn't mean in every single site they're going to do exceptionally well, and they haven't for Rami. So and you can see his rows. I mean, I think this is a row of 70 trees long, and I don't know how many he's got, but he chose what he thought was going to work well, and they are not panning out. So again, a word of caution. They may work beautifully. They're a great pair if you can grow them to perfection. And that's as I mentioned in the write-up of this workshop, is that, you know, you can hardly get a better fruit than a pear that's grown and ripened to perfection. But it's so difficult to get that perfectly ripe pear to the consumer. There's an old quote that I am familiar with that says something like, there are 10 minutes in the life of a pear when it's great to eat. So if you don't hit those 10 minutes, we're in trouble. And so what is the pear industry trying to do now? A lot of things, of course, but one of them is to get ready-to-eat pears on the market shelf. Because most people buy a pear that's not ripe and want to eat it. They're not going to let it sit on the counter for several days or longer until it gets ripe. And so that turns off a lot of consumers, and it has for decades. So if we're marketing pears, we can educate our consumers, our customers, but, you know, if we sell to a market, or pardon me, to a store, the consumer we don't have contact with in those cases, and so we want to be sure to get a ready-to-eat pear to them, and we need to be careful about how we do that. So anyway, I thought this was a good example of disease-resistant variety that shows promise, but didn't work for Rami. So pruning throughout the life of a tree. So during the early years, we want to develop that structure, that is the scaffold branches, which are permanent, and they never are pruned. So that's why it's so important at the beginning to start training those branches, to select them. Although I will say, I don't do any pruning in the first couple of years. I let the tree get established, and then I select my scaffolds and train those to where I want them. Once the structure is set, just cut out excessive growth and keep the tree at the desired size. In other words, within your system, and you can choose any system you want, but once you determine that, your pruning is going to dictate, or that training system is going to dictate the type of pruning you do. And then, of course, once the tree is mature, you'll want to remove the old fruiting wood and promote young fruiting wood. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But there's no question that fruiting wood, the best pears are produced on maybe 2 and maybe 3-year-old wood. So once you've gone through 2 or 3 years of production on that wood, you want to renew that. In other words, you want to have coming along about a third of your wood that's maybe 3 years old, a third that's 2 years old, and a third that's going to be 1 year old that will be fruiting the following year. And if you can maintain that, you've got a beautiful cycle going. You'll have a good crop every year of quality fruit, and then you'll have that continuing on. But it does take, and that's why I stressed at the very beginning, that the most important job, I think, is training and pruning. If you master that, you will harvest really good fruit, really great fruit. So here, let's just look at some types of pruning cuts. A heading cut. So that's cutting a branch somewhere along its length. So that would be an example of a heading cut right there at that line there. Now, as I look at this tree, I'm looking at the angle of that branch. I would thin that out. It's too tight of an angle, and it's higher up in the tree. So I would use a thinning cut, which means, removing a branch at the point of origin. The point of origin of this branch is right here along that central leader, take that right out, that would be a thinning cut. Now, let's consider a stub cut. It's similar to a thinning cut, but you leave a short stub with a horizontal cut, which will stimulate the regrowth for a new fruiting branch. So in other words, if you want a fruiting branch where this one is, give it a stub cut right there. That'll wake up those sleeping buds right at the base, and you'll get some nice young fruiting wood coming out there at that point. And so that would be how I would treat that particular branch in this case. And that's a good thing to say, because every tree is different. There's no textbook tree out there. And so you just need to look at each tree as an individual. That's why I think mechanical pruning does not work so well. Yes?
Do you have any YouTube about
the shell pruning
that you've done?
I haven't done any, but there are, you can go and find many of them. Yeah. So the other thing that's kind of a new, not so new, but the terminology click pruning, I hadn't heard of it till very recent years. But it's cutting the base of one-year-old wood, leaving a couple of buds, sleeping buds, and that pushes those buds on the stem behind the click as well. So what you're doing is you go down just on that one-year wood, click it right there, cut it off, and then you'll get some nice young wood coming out there if you want that extension. And it'll also break buds that are behind that click or that pruning. And so you'll eliminate what's so-called blind wood, where there's just a branch and no laterals or fruiting spurs coming out. So again, what we want to do is to have fruit from that tip all the way into that central leader. If we can accomplish that, then we're producing the most fruit on a given unit that we can. And that's what we're trying to do as fruit growers to be successful marketers. Here are a couple of other techniques to accomplish that: notching and girdling and scoring. So you're cutting right above a bud, and it's best to do this at sap flow or green tip, just as the trees are beginning to start to grow. And what it's going to do is to energize that bud that's either that has the notching or the girdling, and then it's going to force those buds to break, and it'll also fill in some blind wood behind that, if that's what you desire. Again, we'll talk a little bit more about this technique. You also, in combination, as I said, with removing the apical dominance. So if you remove the tip, and you also score or girdle some buds lower on that branch, you'll get nice young laterals coming up below what used to be that tip, and also all the way back down. So that's the idea. Yes?
So, what's your decision
rule regarding pruning? You mean pruning off a branch?
Yeah, why do you decide to girdle rather than prune it off?
Right. If you don't need that branch there, prune it off. If you want to keep that branch in that space, you have options. You can stub prune it. You can totally do the thinning pruning. You could even head it if you wanted to extend the growth of that, but if you want to keep it shorter, you'd probably want to either thin it or stub it. Or if it's a fine branch but it doesn't have fruiting wood on it, then you would choose to either do some technique like the girdling or the notching.
I'm sorry, but I still don't understand. I mean, if you're girdling, you're going to kill the branch.
No. That'll heal over in a matter of weeks. So I don't know. I'm sorry I didn't repeat that question, but the question had to do with how do you decide when to use these techniques such as girdling or notching versus just pruning that branch right off. So what you're doing is very, you're cutting through the cambium for sure into the wood, so you're breaking that flow, but you're definitely, on these young trees, something like this young wood, that will heal within that same season for sure. Now, if you do girdle it, I mean, that's a little more drastic. If you do that, then you get a terrific wood storm, wind storm. It possibly could break that branch off because it's weakened somewhat. Yeah, but okay. Yeah, it does. It does mean that, and generally, I agree. So probably it's better to use scoring, but it is in fact girdling. Yes. Blindwood is a length of a branch or stem that has no fruit buds on it. It's blind, basically, in that context. Okay, now there are a lot of rules of pruning out there. These are some I selected. Prune early winter for a vigorous response, at flowering or later for a weak response. So if you have a very moderate vigor tree, you may want to, or even a weaker vigor tree, you may want to prune it when in full dormancy so that so you get some increased vigor there. But if you have a very vigorous tree, you want to calm it down. You don't want a lot of vegetative growth. That can happen so easily. So wait until at least green tip or flowering, post-flowering, and then your response will be very, very diminished. So that's an important rule right there, because if you do all your pruning right there in the dormant season, irregardless of the vigor of the tree, it's not one size fits all. A very vigorous tree is just going to respond like gangbusters, and you're going to be faced with excessive vegetative growth in that season and in every other season coming forward. So keep that in mind, please. Let's see. Prune out big wood and branches with tight angles. I mentioned that example, previous slide, one of the previous slides, tight angles. You just, they're weak. You do want them spread out a bit for strength and for fruiting. And any big wood, kind of a rule of thumb is if a branch along a central leader is a third or greater in size than the central leader, prune it out. It's just going to be competing with that leader to too much of an extent. Make thinning versus heading cuts. And again, sort of rehashing that, a thinning cut, you just get rid of that branch. And that's what you want. If you don't need a branch in that area, that's the preferred cut. If you want to maintain something there, maybe you want to head it. Maybe you want to stub it, but because you want to fill that space. But if for no other reason, prefer a thinning cut. Delay topping the tree after flowering for a less vigorous response. In other words, if the tree is at its desired height, you definitely do not want to top it in the dormant season, because it's going to just sprout vigorously at the top again, and then you're constantly fighting that growth. So wait until even after flowering. I mean, you'll get some good, you'll reduce the response if at the beginning or at the end of dormancy, at the staps flowing, it's green tip, but you'll get even a less vigorous response if it's flowering or after flowering.
You said if you wanted to reduce the height, though, to prune, winter prune. Did I hear that right?
Okay, so the question is, if you want to reduce the height of a tree, do you winter prune? I'm saying the answer I would say would be if you have a desired height height that you want to maintain, probably it's better to cut after dormancy. So you get a weaker response because you don't want a very vigorous response in the very top of the tree if you're trying to keep it at that given height. And then, of course, again, a reiteration, keeping the young fruiting wood for the highest quality fruit. Now, we're in Northeast Iowa. We have a fruit growers club, a group of folks that are growing fruit, various kinds, including orchards. And when we get together, every spring, we have several pruning days. We go to each other's places. We go to backyard fruit growers like this here. We prune in church school orchards. And so we have a lot of opportunities to prune trees. And what we usually do is we walk around that tree and look for that one single cut that's going to open up that canopy to the most sunlight. So that's the very first thing. And I would recommend that without question, is look for that one big cut. Of course, we do a lot more cutting after that. And then really, one can get carried away with this pruning as well. So somebody at some point or another is going to say, time to walk. And we just walk away. Whether or not it's satisfactory to everybody or not, but we just have to do that. But it's a good exercise. And I'll contrast our local amateur fruit growers, so to speak, with the pros. So again, in that magazine I passed around, The Good Fruit Grower, I saw this nice article. So here's an old Anjou pear, and they got together six experienced pruners to demonstrate their skills. They all had similar approaches. They were at a neutral orchard, by the way. And here's what they came up with. Everybody, irregardless of what their personal techniques and style was, said one or two big cuts. And you'll see this repeatedly. And the advice to give, if you're an orchard manager and you have pruners coming in to do your pruning, the best first instruction you want to give them is to demonstrate by going out there on a tree, walk all the way around it, and look for that one or maybe two big cuts that you can make. You've selected your scaffolds. They're never pruned. But trees just start growing. And they may not be what you want to keep forever. And so maybe that's the big cut you want to make. So that's the first step, in my opinion. And apparently, it seems to be universal, really. And then something that haven't done a lot of, but it's favoring large buds. So these guys are commercial growers, and they know when they look at a bud, if that bud is going to produce a high quality fruit or not. So in my opinion, that's a skill that would be really good to hone. Most of us have not looked that closely at the buds. Yes, we look at them to size up the potential crop that's coming along. We look at those fruit buds. Developing a keen eye to know that branch doesn't have quality buds on it, and it's coming out, or it's going to be rejuvenated, is, I think, a good step to take. And so this is a 60-year-old pear tree. Look at the size of the branches and the limbs, but look at the size of that fruiting wood. I'm going to say that none of this fruiting wood is older than 3 or 4 years old. It is being rejuvenated on this cycle of 3 to 4 years, or usually it's a 3-year cycle, but it does happen. It can be done. So here's what we're looking at. Usually the fruit buds are on short stems or at the tips. Vegetative buds are flatter against the stem. The next few slides just showing some older trees and some of the techniques that people have used to get young fruiting wood. Very different shapes, but getting young wood. This is one of my favorites. I don't know the size of or the age of that tree, but look at the girth and look at the size of it. And then look at all of that flower buds and fruiting wood on that tree. And all the way down to practically to the ground. Obviously, all of this wood, some of it may be a little older than 3 or 4 years, but not much. It's all very young fruiting wood. So again, the pruning that allows us to keep young wood coming along on probably an ideal, of course, 3-year cycle, but maybe 4, maybe 5, depending on one's schedule, other work. But that allows a couple of things. Again, getting back to that those initial comments about getting sunlight into the whole canopy. And of course, that's why if you've got big trees, you need to cut out the big branches. I mean, obviously they top that. It looks to me like it's got to be several inches in diameter way up there and here. So, you know, they worked at this tree. I mean, this was an old tree that had a lot of large growth branches. They brought it in closer to the main stem and then worked at getting this young fruiting wood coming along. And I really like this statement. A fruit tree is as old as its fruiting wood. Pretty cool. Well, here's an espalier. I've often read and heard that pruning is a science and an art. And the way I interpret that is that it's based, the science part of it is based on keen observation. In other words, if we make a cut and we see what happens to the tree as a result of that cut, if we observe that and know that every time we make that certain kind of a cut, this is generally the response we get, then we are paying attention. And we can predict what a pruning cut, will result in. And that, to me, is the science part of it. A keen observation is really something about that. And then if we use that skill, develop that skill to produce something of beauty, in my eyes, any form of a tree is a beautiful thing. But it also has been taken to this form here as an espalier. I mean, this tree may be decades old, but it's trained in a certain way. I wondered often about that growth up on top. Maybe, and I don't know this, these lower branches aren't producing enough carbohydrates through photosynthesis to sustain that whole system, and so they're letting some other limbs or stems grow for more photosynthetic leaves anyway. So, but probably enough said about that then. And then let's quickly go through this part here. I see we're running a little later than I expected, but we're getting along. So we need to know or try to figure out when is a pear mature? And there are several signs. Usually, it will change color from green to a lighter green, but that's a very subtle thing. Sometimes we can see it, sometimes it's questionable. Usually, if we can pick up the fruit in our hand and give it a twist upward, if it breaks off at the point of attachment, it's ready to be harvested. It is mature. And check the insides. If the seeds are brown or black, it's a mature fruit. If you do this periodically throughout the season, you can see this change, and it will be very apparent when the color changes. And the fruit is sweet. Obvious starches are converted to sugars as the fruit matures, and so give it the taste test. And then finally, flesh firmness decreases. And with the known varieties, there has been enough research to know at what firmness that fruit is mature. And we'll look at that using an instrument called a penetrometer. And as I mentioned there, it correlates flesh firmness with pear maturity. And that, you can see a handheld unit here, an analog, a digital one, and a couple of more sophisticated type models. But it requires a baseline of firmness to be available or determined. So for example, Bartlett, we know that a firmness of 19 to 22 foot-pounds is the range of maturity that within which it should be harvested. If it's harvested at 19 foot-pounds maturity, then it can be stored longer. If it's harvested at the extreme edge of that firmness, the storage length is somewhat decreased. So those are factors that need to be considered. And they're available out there I don't know what the lowest price is, but certainly well under $100 or several hundred for the more sophisticated machines. Seeds become brown or black. Give it the taste test. Those are gourmets, by the way. Very subtle changes in a couple of weeks here, or a few weeks. Most pears require a chilling or what's called conditioning period. In other words, once harvested, put into cold. Here are a couple of different storage units. Brooke, you might recognize that one on the right. That's at your farm. and this one's down at Buffalo Ridge in Iowa. At any rate, so as I said, how long you chill it depends on the maturity at the harvest. And what's going on here is that basically those pears require some ripening stimulus, and that chilling period will stimulate the production of ethylene, which is a ripening agent. So, and then when that pear is brought out to a warmer place, it will ripen up. And got a cramp in my hand. Yes. How cold? I in my own refrigeration, I've used a cool box that I built, our cooler, and I maintained it. Or the best I could do with that unit that I got early on was about 38 degrees. And that worked well for most varieties. Yeah. Okay, so the questions are, again, at what temperature? And I would say, so if you can do something below 30 degrees, or pardon me, 30, high 30s or 40 degrees or lower, not freezing, of course, not going below 32. So that's the one thing. We've been very successful keeping pears in storage for about weeks or months even at 38 degrees. And the second question was? How do you know when you've chilled it long enough? you have to sample. In other words, I would say this. I don't know how long to till or condition many varieties. So I would say that a minimum chilling of several days, bring some pears out, put them on the counter at room temperature or even warmer, and look at those over days and see if they're getting ripe. And so, again, there's another little piece of information that we need to work on for some of these varieties that we just don't know all that about. Yes. Can you over-till? The question is, can you over-till pears? I don't know. I don't think so. But you might be able. It might happen. That's why I would say we need to come up with that information. Yeah. So just try it. Yes.
Do you need to chill the pears if you're just sending them to be turned into sauce or spirits?
Do you need to chill the pears if you're marketing them to a saucer or someone who's going to sauce them or parry them or whatever? I would say yes. And I'm only making the connection between a ripe pear being a higher quality pear. And so no matter what the added to product is, like if it's applesauce or parry or whatever, especially applesauce, I would think you'd get a more density-rich, nutrient-rich, nutrient-dense, rich product in your applesauce, just as you would in the fruit itself. Yeah. Yes. So the question or the comment has to do with having pears and not seeing that there's any blemish or disease or anything wrong with them from the external appearance, but yet once they're put into storage and taken out, they seem to have broken down internally. I would say most likely that those are pears that were harvested or left on the tree beyond their maturity cycle. Because pears left on the tree, and we're talking here about winter pears. I mean, obviously the summer pears are going to be, early pears are going to be picked early on, and we're not going to let them hang on the tree late in the season. But the main crop season pears, if they're left on the tree, are going to break down internally, and you won't notice that. They'll look like perfectly wonderful pears. They'll color up, and you'll harvest them, and they'll be already starting to break down internally. Yep. Okay, so let's see if we can get through this. This is a recent release, 10 minutes. So I'm glad we've had the questions, because we're not going to have a lot of time left over here. I only have a few more slides, but the questions have been coming along nicely. I bring this up only because this is because it's an early season, and when you see that color change, and that's what the University of Minnesota folks are saying, when to harvest this particular pear is watch carefully for that color change, and it will both be mature and ripe at that point. So you'll want, as soon as you see that color change, you can pick it, and apparently it's ready to go to eat. And you don't, in this case, as in lots of early pears, not need a chilling or conditioning. And apparently it stores pretty well. Some of us are trying to source these UC Jewels, and they don't seem to be out there yet, although it was released 2021. Yes. Okay, the question, again, I'm not sure I got the whole question. Is there any reason? So the comment or question has to do with a lot of these newer releases tend to be earlier season. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. This one just came out in 2021. The Canadian breeding program in 2021 came out with a pear variety called Happy. And there are several others probably that have recently come out. I'm not sure. Why? The pear industry has come up with a slogan here that they have said, USA Pears have said, check the neck. In other words, it's a marketing campaign to just check the pressure on that neck of there's the Bosque, and I think this is the Shenandoah. If it yields to gentle pressure, then it's ready to eat. So again, trying to educate the consumer at the market to be aware that if you do that and it's hard as can be, don't eat it because it won't be a pleasant experience likely. And finally, in this case, I like this quote from Michael Phillips, the late Michael Phillips, mentor to many of us. Learning the ropes of particular pear varieties with respect to picking date and post-harvest chill nuance is ultimately the work of a lifetime. So that actually addresses a couple of the questions that we've had here right now. These are obviously, so this is our fourth section. And we've only got a short time, but we have had a chance to talk a little bit, but we'll get to the Lorette pruning system. These are obviously not pears. These are probably close to 100-year-old Cortland apples. And they have kind of an interesting shape. But what can you tell about this? What I can see here is that the sunlight can get into most of that crown. Yes, it's going to, so that however this tree is managed, there's going to be fruit, and it's going to be lower to the ground, easier to get to and harvest, and probably of quality. So that's the end of the slides. We've got about 5 more minutes, and we can take some more questions, but we do, I'll take one here, and then we'll get to the Lorette pruning. Absolutely, absolutely. I have a kind of an idea of the window. I mean, if it's an early pear, you start early. If it's a mid-season, you start end of August, maybe even. And do those things. Check the ability if it breaks off at the point of attachment. Taste it. Look, cut it open. Look for the seeds. So the question there was. Yeah, what to look for. They are, okay, because I'm of the opinion that Asian pears can ripen on the tree. So you just have to figure out when that ripeness is, I guess. I'm not too experienced with Asians, but I've grown several varieties. So that question had to do with Asian pears being more difficult to deal with, yeah.
My question is, when you're trying to make sure that you have some branches that are 1 year old, some that are 2, some that are 3, do you have a system for knowing how old branches are, or do you just memorize like how long that branch has been there?
No, you can see the growth. There will be rings at each year's growth that you can then interpret. In other words, start at the terminal, go back, and you'll see right where that wood started for that 1 year growth, and then the same going backwards. So I'm sorry I didn't repeat that question, but it had to do with how do you tell 1 and 2 and 3 year old wood. Yes.
Could you share a little bit more about the winter Nels pear? I've had a few bad winter pears from Argentina, and I'm curious about the keeping pear, the winter Nels.
Winter Nellis?
Yes.
Yeah, well, winter Nellis, it's a relatively small pear. It's heavily russeted. It's a, I've picked it in November, and I've kept it well into, you know, January and February. But again, tasting it and looking at it closely throughout the time, so that every fruit's going to be a little different. So you can't, I mean, you can generalize, but you have to be watchful. I like winter Nellis. It's a great late season pear. Yeah, so I'm reminded that there's the grafting workshop this evening in this room, and it starts at 6:30. So 6:30 if you're interested, and there will be rootstock available and signwood. I didn't get it.
My question is about cider apples, and it's a couple part question about cider. Cider pears, not apples, are making. So, with Luscious Gourmet and some of the most popular ones, are those also good for cider? And then, secondly, are there any other particular pear varieties that are best for making like perry or cider spirits? And third, how is the convergence being in Decorah maybe like affecting to what extent you should be growing spirit pears for fermenting and making alcohol?
Okay. So that was a three-part question. Let's see. Oh, yeah. The first one had to do with what about these more popular varieties? Are these varieties like Luscious and Gourmet suitable for making perry? And I'm not sure. I think we have to experiment with these varieties. I've not experimented with them for making perry, and I don't know of others who have. So we need to learn all that. The second part of that second question had to do with? Yeah, so there are, just like for cider, there are cider apples, there are perry pears. And we're out of time. So anybody who needs to leave, what I'll say is this is the end of the workshop, and that anyone who wants to talk, thank you. Thank you. Yes, anybody, I'm happy to keep this conversation going, and we can talk more about it. Yeah. One thing I didn't mention, but if you're interested, I did bring some of my pruning tools and other odds and ends here to look at. So anyway. Pardon? Yeah, University of Minnesota.
Wow, and so does it have the disease resistant
radiation? Yeah, it's supposed to. So, yeah, but it's hard to access right now. I mean, Harry put in an order for a couple hundred. I was tagging along on that, and he hasn't heard anything about it yet. So he doesn't know if he is getting any, Harry Hope, yeah.
Or you.
If he doesn't get them, I won't. Okay, my experience is that I get bloom clustered pretty closely. Most of the varieties overlap to some extent. I haven't really been keenly aware of varieties that, you know, have a real